And very fittingly, given your question earlier, we're going to consider tools to do astrophysics. In particular, we're going to ask the question, can we salvage the notions of energy, kinetic energy, momentum, and angular momentum in general relativity? We know, of course, we can if we have Killing vector fields. If there are symmetries, then we have conservation laws, both for fields and for geodesics of particles. But what if we don't? Like in astrophysics, we don't. Right? There really is no Killing vector field in nature. Maybe to some approximation there will be, but in practice there is no strict Killing vector field. So, on the other hand, we feel that there ought to be a way to do something like what we're used to from Newtonian mechanics. If, for example, we have two galaxies, just like the Milky Way and Andromeda, that they're about to get to collide. For example, here, these two galaxies have started to interact. Those two galaxies. Could it be that some of these are the same? No, because we would have to travel a long distance to take pictures of them from different perspectives, right? We see everything only from one perspective. Anyway, so if we want to calculate the processes of that happen when, for example, two galaxies collide, then according to Newtonian mechanics, yeah, well, kinetic energy and there's momentum conservation, there's angular momentum conservation. But we know that there's not going to be Killing vector fields there. So is there something like angular momentum that's conserved in a collision of galaxies, or kinetic energy, or momentum? And the answer is yes. And the intuition for this is the following. It's true that in there, curvature is highly non-trivial. It's both space-dependent, so therefore no momentum conservation. It's also time-dependent, so therefore no energy conservation. And of course, it's also non-rotationally symmetric, so no angular momentum conservation. But far away from where the two galaxies collide, we can assume space-time to go back to pretty much flat, almost Minkowski space, where we do have symmetries. And so we can expect that maybe there is no local conservation law of energy, momentum, or angular momentum. But globally, there may exist quantities that when we integrate them over the entire region of the action, they are conserved. Because if we integrate over the whole thing, then we just have one blob that lives in a background of Minkowski space. That's the overall motivation to think that there might be conservation laws. And in fact, that's possible. And it's also very important. I mean, why would we want to study the dynamics of galaxies, for example? Well, a very important reason why we want to do that is that the dynamics is governed by the amount of matter that's around. And we know that there is way more dark matter than visible matter. And in order to get a handle on where the dark matter is and what dynamics it has, we need to study what the visible matter does. So, if we have conservation laws, we can calculate through these collisions, at least to some extent, and from that infer what the dark matter does. At least the conservation laws will help us infer that. Remember the statistics. We have that visible matter is only 5% of the matter that's out there, and of the energy and matter that's out there, and then 72% roughly is dark energy, and 23% is dark matter. So 95% is not visible. All right, so what we will use for this purpose is the tetrad formalism. And basically we'll use it, in this case, not to, I mean, we used the tetrad formalism before, the formalism of frames before, in order to be able to set the metric to be eta mu nu everywhere. But there is another use of all of this formalism, which is that we can now formulate tensor value differential forms, which allows us to integrate tensor valued things. So that's the purpose that we will use the tetrad formalism for today. We used it before to either have g mu nu of x equal to eta mu nu. We used it before to have the eta mu nu everywhere so that we could solve the Dirac equation everywhere by using the same gamma matrices. That's not our purpose today. We will not require that g is actually eta everywhere. Instead, we will make use of the fact that we get tensor-valued forms. All right, so global conservation laws. Remember that in special relativity, energy and momentum conservation, yeah, thanks for closing the door. In special relativity, energy and momentum conservation arise from time translation invariance and spatial translation invariance. And of course, rotational invariance leads to the conservation of angular momentum. And the invariance means, of course, that if you do a translation in time, then a solution goes into a solution. If you have a solution and you translate it in space, you get a solution. If you take a solution and to the equation of motion and you rotate, then you get a solution again. That's no longer true on a generic curved space-time. What we did find is that the energy momentum tensor obeys this this covariant conservation, which, however, is kind of disappointing because it's not actually a conservation law. It doesn't express a symmetry. Remember, this doesn't express a symmetry of the space-time. It's true for every space-time, and it arises simply from the diffeomorphism invariance of the theory. That's not a conservation law. It's just that statement. It doesn't mean that a certain divergence is vanishing. Only if we also have a Killing vector field, then we can contract the Killing vector field with the energy momentum tensor, and then we get a conservation law. So that would give us a local conservation law. So in conclusion, only if a space-time does not change in a particular direction, space, time, or rotation, only then, that is to say, if it possesses a Killing vector field, then locally solutions go to solutions under these transformations, such as translations or rotations or translations in time, and then we get a conservation law. But that's not true in general. And here's the idea. When we have regions of a significant gravitational effect, for example, galaxies collide, there is usually no Killing vector field. But if we consider a sufficiently large system, so if these are the two galaxies that are about to collide, then we can consider a sufficiently large box, large enough so that out there, the space-time becomes pretty much flat. Now, this box, we can look at, it's a three-dimensional box, and we can look at it at a point in time. And then that's some space-like hypersurface. And we assume the box to be chosen large enough that we basically have Minkowski space out there. This is going to be important, because we're going to be integrating over energy momentum tensor and over things to do with the curvature. And if we make the box large enough so that we have Minkowski space out there, well, then it means that the energy momentum tensor is vanishing out there, because Minkowski space has vanishing energy momentum tensor. It's a vacuum solution. And also, we want nothing to be there. It's going to be empty. So there's no, the energy momentum tensor doesn't contribute. And also, there should be no curvature out there. So we're going far enough out there. Then we would expect that there ought to be, if not a local energy, a local gravitational energy, there ought to be at least a total energy in there. I already started to mention something new now. I mentioned the word gravitational energy. Right? If we have two galaxies that collide, we would expect that what's going on in some good approximation is that they are in a gravitational potential. One produces a gravitational potential for the other, which is why they collide in the first place. So we expect that there's a gravitational potential energy between them, and that makes them then move, and it turns into kinetic energy, intuitively. And according to Newton, that's what would happen. But according to general relativity, there cannot be any gravitational potential energy, because the metric can always be put into the form of just eta mu nu. So there cannot exist such a thing of a local gravitational potential. You can always choose a Riemann normal coordinate system anywhere, and then there it's just Minkowski space. So this leads to the following question. If there is no gravitational energy, if there's no gravitational potential energy, then how could we have a total box energy in there? We would expect it from classical mechanics to consist of the kinetic energies, other potential energies like electrostatic, magnetostatic potential energies and things like that, plus gravitational potential energy. And it should not be negligible. It should be super important, that gravitational potential energy. So, is there such a thing as gravitational potential energy? The basic idea being that, of course, the total energies of gravitation and the other energies should be what is conserved. So what could be a gravitational potential energy in general relativity? Given that these Christoffel symbols that describe the tidal forces and generally what gravity does can always locally be made to vanish. So there's no local notion of gravitational energy. And as we will discuss at the end of the lecture, today will be a relatively short lecture. As we discuss at the end of the lecture today, we should also expect that there is, if there is gravitational potential energy, that it can be volatile, that it can escape in the form of gravitational waves. So it could be that we have this box, and we sum up all the energies in there, like the kinetic energies, the potential energies, then we have some volatile energy. For example, electromagnetic radiation, light, can escape the box. We are used to that, but gravitational potential energy can also be turned into the production of gravitational waves. For example, when two stars in spiral, but it also happens when two galaxies crash, you can have gravitational waves. And they too can travel and escape the box. So, gravitational potential energy. I made a big fuss about that not existing, but now we're going to have a whole lecture about it anyway. So, indeed, the intuition was right, namely that if we take a box big enough, so that we basically, at the boundary, are in the regime of Minkowski space, then we have some stuff in Minkowski space. And therefore, we should have translation invariance of the entire box, rotation invariance of the entire box, and translation invariance in time. So we should have a box momentum, a box energy, a box total energy, a total angular momentum. And you can do that around each one of the galaxies before they collide, for example. And then have them collide and then the whole thing for the total. So that's the intuition. But how can we do this mathematically? And the strategy is this. We take the Einstein equation in the formalism of tensor-valued forms. Remember, the Einstein equation then looks like this. Here is the energy momentum or stress energy one form with the, remember it's one tensor valued one form. The hot star turns it into a three form. And these are just gravitational constant times 8 pi. Here we have the curvature two form. It's a two form with two indices that are anti-symmetric and suppressed because it's a two form. It's a differential form, so we don't write the indices. And those two indices are contravariant ones. So we have a 2-0 value, 2-0 tensor valued two form. That's what the curvature two form is. And we have the wedge product with this capital eta. It looks like an H. It is an H, but it's supposed to be an eta. The Greek letter eta capitalized looks like this, apparently. And remember what the definition of this H was? It's the Hodge star of the wedge product of three basis vectors in the cotangent space, theta alpha, theta beta, theta gamma. This is a one form, one form, one form. The wedge product of the three is a three form. The Hodge star of that is a one form. So this is a one form, this is a two form, therefore the whole thing is a three form. Just like on the other side here, it's a three form, right? Because this is a one form, the Hodge star of that is a three form. And then the indices also match up because there's one index alpha down there, covariant index, and here these two contract and we are left with one index down there. So that's the Einstein equation in the framework of frames. And we will now reformulate that Einstein equation in such a way that on the left-hand side, the only thing that's left over is the d of something. Super important, because if it's the d of something, then we might be able to use Stokes' theorem, right? So we will filter out from this stuff something that's the d of something. And then on the right-hand side, we have still the energy-momentum tensor. And we have things that we move from the left to the right. Okay, so the curvature part of the Einstein equation, this is the energy part, that's the curvature part. The curvature part of the Einstein equation, we will split into two contributions. One which is the d of something, which is to say that it's an exact form. So we will have an exact form plus the rest, and the rest goes over here. And that's going to be the hot star of this little t alpha. And these t index alpha are called the Landau-Lifschitz forms. Once you put the hot star on them, there are three forms. And so these are called the Landau-Lifschitz differential three forms. So overall, we're going to have that this, in effect, will not contribute because it's an exact form. Now, d squared is zero, and we are going to be able to use the Stokes theorem then. And then on the right-hand side, we have the stress energy. This is the energy-momentum tensor that comes from matter, from radiation and matter. And that has its origin on the left-hand side, which is curvature. So this will be, and together they will form a new energy-momentum tensor, a new energy-momentum one form, which contains both the old-fashioned energy-momentum that comes from energy and matter, radiation, etc., and the part that comes from gravity. Now, we will have to prove that this is possible, that we can split this in a non-trivial way, such that we get an exact differential form and something that's a nice three form like that, which we can put on the right-hand side. We'll have to prove that, and we will prove it. But before we go through the technical procedure of calculating that and proving that the Einstein equation can be massaged to put into this form, before we do that, let me explain what the benefit will be of having the Einstein equation in this form. right? And then once we have that, once we see what the benefit will be, then let's go through the trouble and actually calculate it. All right, so assuming we can put the Einstein equation into this new form, as we'll show later, then we can define a new energy momentum tensor. This tau is the sum of the old-fashioned energy momentum tensor plus this part that comes from curvature. And then the Einstein equation takes this form, the d of something, some tensor-valued differential form. That's why the formalism of tensor-valued differential forms is important. So the d of something is equal to 8 pi g square root of g star t alpha. Now, if the Einstein equation can be put into this form, well then, it means that if we apply the d, the exterior derivative, the exterior derivation, onto the Einstein equation, then the left-hand side now vanishes, because d squared is equal to zero. So, zero equal to the d of that. So, zero is equal to the d of square root of g star t alpha. The 8 pi g we can get rid of, right? It's just a factor that we can divide by. So the Einstein equation now takes this simple form. I mean, no, it's not the Einstein equation anymore. It's a consequence of the Einstein equation, right? This is the Einstein equation, and that's a consequence of it. Namely that square root of g star t alpha is closed. The d of it is zero. So it's a closed form. Closed three form. Now, once we know that the d of that three form here is equal to zero, we can use Stokes' theorem. So let's see. This is a three form. What can we integrate it over? We can integrate it over three-dimensional manifolds. So, if we do the d of it, we get a 4 form. And a 4 form we can integrate over a space-time, over a 3 plus 1 dimensional, over a 4 dimensional manifold. So, let's say this is, we call nu. Then we can use here Stokes' theorem. So, we have if d is some 4 dimensional space-time region, then we have that the integral of dv, so this thing, equal to the integral over v, integral over just the boundary of that four-dimensional space-time region. How should we imagine a four-dimensional space-time region? Remember the box that we drew around a galaxy or a pair of galaxies? That box is a point in time, and it's a three-dimensional piece of space, right? Now imagine we look at a movie of this over some millions of years, let's say 1 million years. Then we have a box in space, which is also extended in time for 1 million years. Now that's a 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time region. It's a well-defined region in space and a certain amount of time. That's a 4 dimensional space-time region. That will be our d. It's some 4 dimensional space-time region. So, because of Stokes' theorem, and because this is the case, we obtain this equation. How? Well, let's take that equation and integrate it over our four-dimensional space-time region. The box around the galaxies for a whole million years, let's say. Then we have the integral over this, over the four-dimensional box. That's here. So I just carried this forward, and we integrate here over d, which is our four-dimensional space-time box that's extended in space and in time by 1 million years. The d of, and this is a three form, remember, that's a one form, that's a three form. After we apply the d to it, it's a four form. So this four form we integrate over this four-dimensional space-time. Since this thing is zero, it's still zero after integrating it. So zero equal to this. By Stokes' theorem, instead of taking the exterior derivative of that form, we can take the co-boundary operator on our space-time region. Remember, this is also called the, sorry, this is the co-boundary operator, and that's the boundary operator. Right? This is the point of Stokes' theorem, that this, instead of writing here the co-boundary operator acting on the differential form, we can drop that D, just write nu itself, and then use the co-boundary operator down here on the region. That's what we do here. So now we're integrating this without the co-boundary operator, but we apply the boundary operator here. So this is now a three-dimensional space-time submanifold. How does that thing look like? It's the boundary to our box around the galaxies that's a million years old. That's running for a million years. Right? That's the boundary that we are talking about here. That's the del D. Okay. So our region D is the box. So remember the box around our two galaxies. All of that box is just symbolized here by this little interval here. It's just one dimension in space, but really it's three dimensions in space. But I'm symbolizing this here by just one dimension in space. So X stands for spatial extent. And then here T is the time variable. And so this is the duration of, let's say, a million years or whatever. So our box, our three-dimensional box around the galaxies is being sort of replicated here for every point in time up until here. So this is the box, but that's the box as well. And then we run here time upwards. And the whole set of events, I mean, the box has as its point locations, but D, the space-time region, has as its points events. So it's all those events that happened in that box within a million years. So capital T is like a million years, running from time T1 to time T2. Okay, so, and we choose the space-time region to be so large, we choose the box B so large, that out here we have, see, these are the ends of the box. The box is so large that we have basically Minkowski space out there. Right. Equation star, which was that again? Huh. I don't know how to go back with this thing. Sorry, I don't know. Anyway. So we obtain now, remember that from Stokes' theorem we had that this equation holds because the d squared was zero. So this is the equation that we have from Stokes' theorem. And it has boundaries. It consists of an integral over the boundary del d. So that's that boundary here. What is that? This is an integral over the box, the spatial box at time t1 down here. It's an integral over the spatial box at time t2 up here. And it's an integral over these sides up here. All right? That's what our integral becomes. And that, in total, is zero. Now, this second, the third term here, though, is vanishing. That integral is vanishing. Any ideas why that's vanishing? Well, it's because we assume the box to be so large that we just have empty Minkowski space out there. So we're assuming empty Minkowski space out there. We're assuming, too, that there's no electromagnetic or gravitational radiation that makes it all the way out there. So we assume our box to be very, very large and Minkowski space out there. That means that there is neither gravitational energy over there, nor is there energy momentum of the usual kind over there. It's just empty Minkowski space. But that means that the T alpha, with both of its components, the energy momentum of the traditional kind and the part that came from the left-hand side, the curvature part of the Einstein equation, both of them are assumed to be vanishing because the box is spatially large enough. That means that out there, at the boundaries of the box where this integral takes place, we have no contribution. But that means that the sum of these two integrals is zero. This being the integral over the box at an early time, and that being the integral over the box at a late time. See, that's the kind of thing we want. We want that if you integrate a certain quantity at early times, you get the same thing as if you integrate this quantity over late times. It's a conservation law. Except that, shouldn't that be a minus sign, right? I mean, this term we can already assume is gone. Then we have zero equal this plus that. Wouldn't it be nice if this was a negative of that? So that we can put it on the other side and say that it's the same integral. No, not quite. So first of all, we notice that the third term goes away, right? That's what we just argued, that we make the box large enough so that we are at empty Minkowski space there, so the third term goes away. And now we have this equation here. We have that the integral over the spatial box that contains the two galaxies at time t1 plus integral over the spatial box at time t2 equal to zero. But remember what Stokes' theorem tells us. It tells us that a certain integral over volume is equal to a certain integral over the surface of that volume. But that surface integral, you can view as an integral. Remember that when you do a surface integral, you have to define the normal to the surface. And in Stokes' theorem, this has to be either consistently always the normal pointing to the inside, or always the normal pointing to the outside. This means that in this integral here, if one of them, let's say this one, is calculated with a normal pointing outside to the future, then this one would be pointing to the past. So therefore, if we define the integrations over these surfaces at early time and late time with both of the orthogonal vectors, the vectors orthogonal to the surface, to be future pointing, then one of the signs is flipping. That means that we have that the integral over the new energy momentum, the one that has the matter energy momentum and the gravitational energy momentum, over the spatial box at the early time, future pointing, is equal to the integral over the same box at the late time, also future pointing. So we have a conservation law. So what we define then is the total ADM, so-called ADM, after Arnowitz, Dieser, and Miesner, who did this calculation first. We define the total ADM for momentum to be these expressions. So it's P mu is square root of G, and then the Hodge dual of T mu. So mu is running from 0 to 3, so we get these four vectors here. And but this equation here tells us that this four vector is conserved in time. Now, that is in fact a four vector with respect to the Minkowski space, with respect to the asymptotic Minkowski space. So what we have is conservation of a four momentum. That four momentum, though, is not localized. The four momentum that's conserved is the result of an integral over the entire box, where you have to choose your space-like hypersurfaces, and then you have to integrate over these terms that come from both the energy momentum tensor of matter and radiation, and also the contributions from the curvature. Right, so that's great. We have a conservation law here. Now, we have to prove that the starting point is valid. Because remember, the starting point was the assumption that we can take the Einstein equation, and on the left-hand side, we split all of this curvature stuff into two pieces. An exact differential form, that is to say, differential form that's the D of something, and a remainder. And that remainder we plug into the right-hand side. We shove it over to the right-hand side and declare it to be part of the energy momentum tensor. Because then, if we can do this, if we can write this as the D of something plus a term that we put over here, then, as you saw before, we can apply D to the Einstein equation, then the left-hand side is vanishing, and we get that the D of this is equal to zero, and then we go with that into the Stokes equation, which helps us to, which allows us to write the integral over the D of this stuff, over the volume, is the integral over this stuff, over the surface of the volume, and then the at the boundary of the box, we have Minkowski space, therefore no contribution from the T's, so we only have an integral at the early time, integral at the late time, and they're equal, and so we get a conservation law. All right. So, we need to prove that this step is possible. Now, it turns out that it is not only possible, it's possible in multiple ways. And depending on what you're up to, one way may be better than another way. Let me give you one way, and then at the end, I'll tell you about an alternative way to do it. So the choice of splitting the left-hand side of the Einstein equation into an exact form, the D of something, and some other term that then contributes to the energy momentum tensor is not unique. How to fix this choice? Well, one of our priorities might be that we will want to have a notion of angular momentum. So far, I just showed you that we can define the ADM for momentum, and that this is going to be a conserved quantity. But in collision processes, it can be very useful to also have angular momentum conservation. So we can require that. We can say, it's not unique, this split of the gravitational left-hand side of the Einstein equation. So we get to choose something extra. We get to choose something nice. And then, if we're lucky, we can have that, and this will fix the non-uniqueness. And that's the case. But later I will show you that it's kind of a devil's bargain. You may want to do another choice as well. But if we want angular momentum conservation, then we will need the T mu nu is T nu mu for this new energy momentum tensor that has the, I mean, we know it's true, it's always symmetric for the energy momentum tensor that arises from matter and radiation. But now that we have stuff come from the left-hand side of the Einstein equation after doing these funny things with the exact form and so on, it's not so clear that we get this. But there's a proposition which says that there is a unique decomposition of the left-hand side of the Einstein equation such that this new contribution here to the energy momentum tensor is symmetric. And then, and this is a lengthy thing to prove, for this decomposition, we have that these that the T, which is the part that moves over to the right-hand side on the Einstein equation, that that part is this. Now, who would have guessed that? Anyone would have guessed that this is what it is? Okay, so let's see, what is it? So we have this one form again, it contributes to the energy momentum one form, and with hot star, it's the three form again. These things, by the way, are called the Landau-Lifschitz three forms. Okay, and they take the following form. Here we have the wedge product of four basis vectors, theta alpha, wedge theta beta, oh, here it's written, wedge theta gamma and theta delta. Take the hot star of that, it gives you a zero form. And then here you have the connection one form. Various wedge products of it with the basis vectors. Okay, so that's what you get then. Let me sketch the proof for how this works, how you move stuff from the left-hand side to the right-hand side while leaving behind only an exact differential form. Sorry. Okay, so here's a sketch of the proof. We start with the Einstein equation over here. And now we use the second structure equation. Remember what the structure equations were all about. The first structure equation gives you the torsion tensor in terms of the Christoffel symbols, or the torsion two form in terms of the connection one form. What does the second structure equation tell you? It gives you the curvature tensor in terms of the Christoffel symbols, or if you use tensor valued forms, it gives you the curvature two form in terms of the connection one form. So the second structure equation in terms of tensor valued forms gives you the curvature two form in terms of the connection one form. Connection one form, wedge connection one form, D of connection one form. Remember what these guys are, just to make sure. They're basically the Christoffel symbols. Christoffel symbols have three indices, but one of the lower indices has been declared to be the index of a one form, which is why the connection one form is a one form which has two indices, so that in total it accounts for the three of the Christoffel symbol. All right, so the second structure equation expresses the Riemann curvature tensor in terms of the connection. So we can do this. We can plug this into the Einstein equation. Then that's what we get. We get all of this equal to the right-hand side of the Einstein equation, right? So we just carried this forward and substituted this stuff for omega. So now we have this. Now, this here is the exterior derivative of the connection one form, wedge this eta. We can write this as the exterior derivative of the connection one form, wedge eta, the whole thing exterior differentiated. But then we get two terms. We get the term where the D acts on that, leaving this the same. That's the term that we actually have. But we also get the term where the D is acting only on the eta, leaving the omega alone. That term wasn't present in here, so we have to subtract it. So this is that minus this. Now, that part where the exterior derivative is acting on the capital eta here, we can rewrite using something that we had some lectures ago, namely that when we do the absolute covariant derivative of the eta, we get this expression over here. This is zero, so we have that we can express the d of h, the d of eta, as minus of all of this. So here's the Einstein equation. This part we can write like that, where this we can write using this. So the Einstein equation, therefore, now blows up to become all of this stuff. It actually goes on like this and like that, right? So it's in two lines now, the Einstein equation. But the point is that we have the d of something plus some other stuff, which we can then declare to be the little t alpha, the gravitational contribution, which we can then put on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. Yeah, and I'm omitting a few steps here that show that you can make the T alpha beta symmetric, which is what you need in order to be able to get the angular momentum conservation, to be able to define an ADM angular momentum. So we now have all the ingredients to calculate the conserved ADM energy momentum tensor. We anticipated this already. Now that we have this separation of the Einstein equation, where in the left-hand side we have an exact form, and some curvature stuff has been moved to the right-hand side, namely the little t mu, we can define the new energy momentum tensor tau, consisting of the t of matter and radiation, plus the little t that comes from curvature. And then we have to hope that this four vector, which is conserved, also makes physical sense. I mean, we hope that P naught would be something like an energy, and P1, P2, P3 something like a momentum. But really, it wasn't very transparent what went on when we moved curvature from the left-hand side to the right-hand side. This is where the positive energy theorem comes in. The positive energy theorem says that if the so-called dominant energy condition holds, remember that was a condition that's a little stronger than the weak energy condition, if that condition holds, then P naught is indeed larger than zero. So P naught can really be interpreted as a gravitational energy, as an energy that is both gravitational and, of course, also from other sources. Two things to be said about this. One is, what is the dominant energy condition? Remember the weak energy condition. The weak energy condition is that T naught naught in the rest frame of some traveler always has to be positive. So the energy density has to be positive. And further, if that was just the weak energy condition, in order to get the dominant energy condition, you require also that when you take the energy momentum tensor and you contract it with a time-like or light-like vector, then you get a local version of this. You get a local four momentum vector, and we want it to be time-like or light-like. That's the condition, that's the dominant energy condition. It means that even though the flow of energy and momentum that is described by this four vector that you get by contracting the energy momentum tensor with some time-like vector, even though that energy momentum vector may not be conserved, namely if there are no Killing vector fields, we want it to flow into the future. We want it to flow inside the light cone and not outside. So basically, dominant energy condition says that energy and momentum may or may not be conserved. It depends on the circumstances. But in all circumstances, it should always travel only inside or on the light cone, but never outside the light cone. So it's a causality condition. And if you have this dominant energy condition, then in fact, the P naught that we just defined, this global quantity, is in fact also positive. Which is quite non-trivial, because this P naught is not just a global version of the local rho naught of the local energy momentum tensor T mu nu. No, this thing has components from the curvature in it. Right? And so it's quite a non-trivial thing to show that it too is positive. Now, why, by the way, why would we want to ensure that energy is positive? Why, in quantum mechanics, do we want that a Hamiltonian is bounded from below? What would go wrong if energy was not bounded from below?
Infinite explosion?
Yeah, exactly, because then things could fall further and further down and release more and more potential energy in the form of radiation, for example, and so the whole thing would be unstable. In quantum mechanics, it's the uncertainty principle that saves us. Right? Because otherwise, an electron and a positron or an electron and a proton could get closer and closer and, you know, lower and lower in the potential and release more and more energy in the form of radiation. But the uncertainty principle saves us here. I think I mentioned it before earlier in the course, right? Because if delta x gets very small, delta p gets large and it could escape. And gravitationally, there's also something that saves us. On one hand, it could be the dominant energy condition that saves us, but also, for example, for black holes, you could imagine that if matter collapses, if there was no black hole forming, matter could just keep collapsing while falling deeper and deeper into a potential, and then for energy conservation, all of that potential energy would go somewhere, for example, in the form of radiation that's being emitted, and you could have a huge explosion that just never ends and just destroys everything. So black holes stabilize gravity, just like the uncertainty principle stabilizes all the other forces. All right, so how about the angular momentum then? Well, let us choose coordinates that become Cartesian-Minkowski coordinates far out. And then we can define, using our T alphas, which is these, which is the stress energy that contains both the gravitational part and the non-gravitational part of the energy. And we take these products, then we can define something like an angular momentum, but it's both, I mean, it includes not just rotations in space, but also rotations in space and time. And then the proposition is that you can show that the d of this is equal to zero. But for this, we had to split, for this to be true, we had to split the left-hand side of the Einstein equation in this particular way into an exact form and a gravitational part that we move on the right-hand side. Then that is true. And so we get the ADM4 angular momentum, which is conserved by the same logic as before, because we have the d of this is equal to zero. Therefore, d squared of that is equal to zero, and we can calculate with Stokes' theorem a conservation law. Now, as I said, and that's we're coming to the end of this lecture and of this course, as I said, there is a price to be paid. We are getting angular momentum conservation here. We get a notion of angular momentum here, and it's conservation. But we could also have made other choices and split the left-hand side of the Einstein equation somewhat differently. And in particular, we may want to do this to take into account gravitational waves. Because so far, we didn't do this. We simply assume that our box is so large that at the boundaries of the spatial box, we have basically Minkowski space, and the energy momentum tensor is vanishing. And we assume that there's no electromagnetic or other radiation, including no gravitational radiation, that would make it all the way to the boundary. And that could, if it did, mess with our integrals over there. So, in principle, however, it could be. I mean, in the case of two galaxies colliding, maybe there is not that much loss of energy in the form of gravitational waves. But we do know that when two stars are orbiting each other and then eventually colliding and crashing into becoming a black hole or something, that then, at least in the final stages, there's going to be a lot of pseudo-gravitational potential energy being radiated away in the form of gravitational waves, because we can measure them. And so there it is an important phenomenon. And if we are to study conserved quantities, then we would have to take into account the quasi-gravitational energy that is contained in the gravitational waves. And then we have to do a calculation similar to what we did, but not quite the same. And in particular, we would have to define a little bit differently how we use our box. Basically, what we were considering is two galaxies that might be colliding, and then a box that's very large. And so we have a space-like hypersurface, which is to say we choose one point in time, and we look at all the spatial events that happen there, all the spatial locations there. And then we just carry that forward in time to get the space-time box. But a space-like hypersurface doesn't have to be defined in this way. We can define a space-like hypersurface in such a way that intuitively it creeps up the light cone. Right? So it starts creeping up the light cone, and that means that sort of gravitational waves have it harder and harder to escape that box because, you know, they can only travel on the light cone, but our box, our space-like hypersurface is creeping up the light cone. And with tricks like that, you can redo this calculation. It's a little bit more complicated. You can redo this calculation and then capture also gravitational waves in your energy balance there. If you do this, you don't get the ADM four momentum. You get the Sachs-Bondi four momenta, P mu with superscript SB there. And they would then be conserved. I think when I next teach this course, I might add a derivation of these things too, given that gravitational waves have now become so important. We should probably do that then. Okay, but we are done for today. You see, yes. For today and for the course. Okay, so any questions?
Well, if not, then I hope to see some of you maybe next term for the quantum field theory and cosmology course and maybe for the program.